My name is Mark Lund. I'm from Decorah, Iowa, the northeast part of Iowa. I teach at Luther College, and by training I'm an economist. Today I picked as a topic capitalism. And what I would like to do is look at these three different aspects of it. First of all, on paper, what is capitalism? There are a lot of myths and misconceptions that we have. And then what is socialism? Just to look at the other side of the picture. Then second, in the real world, is capitalism, as it looks on paper, really possible? Because we spend a lot of time promoting capitalism. What are the assumptions that underlie this system? And how moral is it or compassionate is it? And then finally, I'd like to say a little bit about the future of economic systems. And although I'll just bring up a few topics today, a few issues, I'll do a lot more with that on the fifth session and also on the second session tomorrow. Before I begin, I think it would be very useful, at least from my point of view, to give you a little introduction, a little bit about my background and what I plan to do, because I think it's very helpful to know who's speaking, where I come from, why I have some of the ideas I have, how they've evolved. And so I'm going to give you only today a fairly lengthy background. First of all, as I've learned, it took a while to learn this and to really understand it, but I'm white. That wasn't too hard. I'm male. I guess that wasn't too tough either. But I'm middle class. I'm a parent. I'm a teacher. I'm a U.S. citizen. And I'm a member of the institutional church. What I'm saying is that I'm at the top. I have an incredible amount of power, despite the fact that I may feel very insignificant at times within the economic system. Still, I'm male, I'm white, I'm a teacher, parent, I live in the United States. That gives me a lot of power. But that, although it may sound like good news, has created some problems for me, because over the last few years, I've begun to see quite clearly that in many cases, I am the oppressor of many people, whether I know it or not, whether it's overt or covert, and I'm also the enemy. And I learned that in a hurry when I travel to other countries in the world, that being from the United States, they don't always see us as a big, wonderful country with great people, but they see us as the enemy. I'm in a position, as Fox says in his book on compassion, and I guess I'll say it right at the outset. I was excited when I heard that Holden had selected the text by Matthew Fox as the major text for the summer. I discovered it a year and a half ago, and I'm not willing to say that there's one single answer to all of our problems. It's a little too risky. But I think what he is talking about in there in compassion is something that I've been struggling with for a long time. And it hits right on the nose, right on the nail, what I think to be one of the major problems. So I'll be making numerous references to Fox during my presentations here at Holden. Well, as Fox says, someone who, like myself, who's white, male, middle class, U.S. citizen, is prepared to be a ladder climber. I'm in a position where I have power. If I want to, I can rise quite rapidly in this system. I don't have to fight certain obstacles because of that. For that reason, it's been very hard for me to try and learn what it's like not to be on the top, not to be the one who tends to be the oppressor in many situations. And over the years, I've developed a real concern for poverty, especially international poverty, and for the oppressed, and for those who are put down. I've been one of those who's always rooted for the underdog, maybe with the exception of the Boston Celtics on occasion. Where did this concern come for those who are on the other side of where I'm at, those who are not white, not male, not middle class, students who are not U.S. citizens? Well, I think it began when I was young. I had good parents, and for that I'm very thankful. especially my father, who was a very compassionate person. And he planted the seeds, I'm convinced, for seeing the world more in the light of Sarah's circle, which I might develop more fully later on, but it's in the second chapter of the Fox book, of more of an equality, equity, where we dance in a circle, we have room for everybody, rather than being ladder climbers, such as he refers to as Jacob's ladder. Well, the seeds were planted when I was young. My father was concerned about some of these things, but like many, from the age of probably 14 to about 21, I fell into the typical white male stereotype. Those were pretty dormant years, I guess. I didn't challenge much. I just enjoyed the position I was in. Played in athletics and did a lot of those things, and it was just very unchallenging, and did not question many things. Then at about 21, the seeds that had been planted when I was fairly young were nurtured and they began to grow. I went to graduate school to study economics, and I must admit that in the graduate school that I attended, I was given the old school, the Jacob's ladder, let's climb the ladder, this is how you succeed, success is as measured in certain terms of moving towards the top. And then I had the, I guess I would call it the fortune, to be on an AID, it's the Agency for International Development, which is the U.S. government arm for development around the world. I worked on that with them for 2 years, and it was sort of a top-down type of development where I was to work with the Ministry of Agriculture down in Peru. But my graduate school experience and my AID experience really opened up some doors. In graduate school, about 150 of the 250 students in our econ and ag econ department were from other countries. And so I shared an office with a fellow who was in Cuba when Castro took over and stayed there for a few years before he left, with a fellow from Jordan, with a fellow from Nigeria, a fellow from Thailand, a couple from Peru, and then a black American from Virginia. Well, when you share an office space in graduate school, and there were two to a room, I was rapidly becoming aware that there were people who were non-white, who were non-middle class, non-U.S., who had a lot of concerns and did not see the world the same way I saw it, or at least the way I was taught. You'd have to say that's where those early seeds that were planted really began to grow. While I was in Peru, I worked on basic needs programs in rural development up in the Sierras with the poor. It gave me a chance to listen to the poor, to hear what they had to say, and to listen to the oppressed. And I had the good fortune of being married and having some daughters. In fact, to see the male-female issue certainly became real because I live with my wife, three daughters, and a female dog. And so I really had an opportunity to see the other side, in addition to the fact of being a parent and working with your children and looking at that whole authoritative democratic issue of how you raise children. Then I went to teach in a liberal arts Christian college and had good exposure to students, and again had a chance to hear some of those who did not come from the same background I did. I've taken students on interims during the month of January. We try to do something a little different and creative, and I've gone to a place called the Ark, north of Minneapolis, which is a little like Holden Village, but on a smaller scale, and we dealt with the issues that are in Matthew Fox's book, the issues, although we did not deal with his book at the time. And I've taken students to third world countries, to East Africa, and to Peru, to try and give them a chance to see what it's like to be in a position of at least being non-U.S. citizen. Well, currently I'm very interested in some of the issues I'll be dealing with this week and the next, I guess, 3 weeks. I'm really pleased to be here at Holden. I'll tell you some of my perspectives, but I want to emphasize that what I plan to do is just share some of my insights, especially as an economist, and I'm very anxious to get some feedback and some input from some of you. I see this as an excellent opportunity for me to learn and further understand what compassion is all about, and what justice is about in the United States and throughout the world. I continue to work on occasion with Lutheran World Federation down in Peru and rural development to keep in touch with the third world so I can listen to what the third world is saying. I must say that it's a real eye-opener to be in a setting like that and to hear that firsthand. And I'm currently on a peace and justice task force for the American Lutheran Church and the Lutheran Church of America colleges and seminaries, where we're trying to get some of these issues into the curriculum. And so I guess I say these things so you know where I'm coming from, the fact that I'm involved, but still relatively new. And I want to stress that because of my background, I haven't necessarily been trained to think in other terms. I mean, I was just taught the system. I just grew up in it. I just knew what my role was. And it hasn't been easy to look at these from a different perspective. I must say, maybe this isn't very Lutheranism, I'm not sure, but I don't feel overly guilty about my position because I'm not so sure that I intentionally created it. I think I was born into it. But I'm very concerned that I try not to perpetuate it. And if I can bring about some changes, I want to do that. The spiral of violence that a lot of people are talking about ever since, I think, Dom Halder-Kammer wrote about it, and it's in the Fox book, is something, too, that is very important to me. We have different types of violence, some very overt. I mean, if I clobber you over the head, you feel the physical pain. But we have the covert, the institutional, the structural violence. And for the last 3-4 years, whenever I meet colleagues or friends, they'll come to me knowing I'm an economist and say, tell me what those structural economic injustices are. I want to know about them. Well, I've been so close to it all that it's still fairly new to me, and I'm still struggling with it. And that's one of the things that we're going to deal with today is when we look at the system of capitalism. I want to say a few things about my perspective, so you have some idea also where I'm coming from. That was a little past history, so you know how some of my thinking has evolved. But my perspective is as an economist. That's my specialization. And I was trained in economic development for third world countries. I'm very interested in economic development, which is meeting material needs, basic needs of people, but within the context of overall human development. I also am very interested in economics and values. That puts me in a very small club amongst economists, because for years we've tried to make economics value-free and to teach it from a quantitative point of view. And if any of you want to get a crash course in introductory economics, I could give you one here in a few hours if you ever wanted to stop by. I could give you the old, not the old school, but what the basic school is of economics. We'd need a blackboard about 15 times that size so I could start drawing my graphs and then get all the quantitative material on there. But I'm very concerned about the values, the assumptions, sort of from a philosophical point of view.
Mark, what is value-free economics? I'm so ignorant of economics, I don't understand.
Sure. It's hard for me to answer because I don't think it exists. I couldn't even tell you what value-free economics is. But what economists have tried to do is to not ask questions about the assumptions. They would make assumptions like people are rational, therefore they will behave this way, and then this crank up big quantitative models that are based on the assumptions. And we don't ask the assumptions. We don't ask what people are thinking inside their heads often enough. We make the assumptions and then we proceed. And we make it very quantitative. In fact, it's kind of embarrassing to think that economists get a Nobel Peace Prize because they think we're like physicists and chemists. And we're a social science. We deal with people. But we've tried to make people, we put them in baskets and we say they behave this way, and then we just forget it and we proceed to analyze what would happen to the economic system based on those assumptions. I don't think it's value free, so it's very hard for me to elaborate on that much further. I come from a Christian perspective. I'd like to think that the reason why I'm dealing with these issues is because I really care. It's not an intellectual game. It's not something that you do to earn a living. Believe me, I won't complain a lot about salaries in the Lutheran schools, but those of us who are economists and in management or in accounting, as my department is, could all go out and triple our incomes probably overnight. I mean, that wouldn't even be an issue. I have a genuine concern here, and I hope those of you who are able to attend some of the sessions will be able to sense that and believe it, because I don't ask these questions and I don't do some of the things I do just because I want to be, an armchair philosopher or just have some fun playing an intellectual game. I'm very concerned, basically for this reason. As an economist, we are here to meet the human or the material needs of people. And I don't make any apologies for that. I mean, the food, clothing, shelter, the basic needs are very important. And yet we live on an earth which is so abundant in resources. And there are people, millions of people, who don't even have the basic needs that are met. And I think we have to sit down and ask the kind of questions about why aren't they being met? What is the problem? We've got to ask some tough questions. And so I ask these questions, I say, not to be a troublemaker, but because I care. There's something wrong when so many people suffer, when we have so many resources on this earth. Or at least I should say, enough resources for everybody's need. Clearly, as Gandhi said, not enough for everybody's greed. So where have we gone wrong? What is our Christian responsibility in all of this? Now, I'm just going to throw out a few other viewpoints that I share that I think will become obvious as I continue over the week. First, I'd like to think of myself as a global citizen, a planetary citizen, a member of God's family. I'm thinking less and less as a resident of Iowa. That doesn't get you anywhere anyway. Less and less as a U.S. citizen. I think that creates enormous problems. And I think more and more of myself as a member of God's whole family and a global citizen. I tend to be somewhat interdisciplinary in nature. That's not easy. I worked for 2 years on an interdisciplinary development team in third world problems. And what we did most of the time was fight because of our different personalities, and we didn't get much work done. And that was frustrating. But I see the need for interdisciplinary work because we tend to specialize, compartmentalize, and I will be the economist and tell you the economic problems, and then you can go down the street and listen to the sociologist, the anthropologist, the engineer, and they'll tell you all of the things that I said that were wrong, and they probably were at least half wrong. You need to work in teams whenever it's possible. At Luther, I teach a course on international issues with a political scientist and a theologian, someone who has studied ethics and the sociology of religion. And I find working in interdisciplinary teams very important. So I will at times talk about political systems. I will talk about psychology. And I may make a fool of myself because I have not trained myself in those areas. But they're important, and I need to bring them in. And where I'm wrong, you correct me. And if nothing else, it would be some food for thought. Third, I really believe in grassroots work, working at the bottom. I think Lauren Halverson wrote an article once, "Let's hear it for the microbes." It's really good. I've been a little frustrated. There's a lot of need to work at the top, government levels, in the case of development, to work with the ministries in different countries. But I think the real work needs to be done in the trenches, right at the bottom in the grassroots. And so I intentionally did not stay with AID or to work at national levels, and I have gone to work with grassroots organizations like Lutheran World Federation. I like teaching, where you're with young people. I guess I like to consider myself still in that category. But bright minds, a lot of energy, and it's just fun batting around the issues, as I say, in the trenches and trying to bring change, and hopefully at the grassroots, the micro level, it will expand to the macro level. I also am very concerned about listening to those who are oppressed and downtrodden. I try very hard to do that. I'm sure I don't do enough of it. I teach at a school that I think is quite elitist, so automatically we have eliminated people from coming there who could teach us an awful lot. I'm anxious, I think, at Holden. My last week or so, there will be some people in here from third world settings. I'm really looking forward to hearing and learning from them. And then the last thing I'll say as far as perspective goes, something I learned in graduate school, and that is the need for humility. When you come out of high school, my major professor, first time I saw him, said, "You know about this much information." Then you go on to college, you learn more, and the amount of information you have is maybe that large. Then you go on to graduate school, and you get your degree, and
think you're pretty important, and the knowledge that you have is even greater. But what happens in that process is you enlarge the amount of information that you've been able to digest. The circumference grows. And what's happened is, down here, when I came out of high school, I was really an authority on a number of things. I pretty much had it figured out. And when I got to college, I realized that, well, I didn't really know all there was to know. I kept bumping up against, as I expanded this information, I ran into new areas that I'd never heard of before. Didn't have any idea how they worked. And by the time you finish graduate school, if nothing else, it should teach you to be very humble in this whole process. You work hard at it. But there's an enormous amount of material that I realize that I don't know. And so again, that's why I look forward to interchanges or exchanges between people like some of you here at Holden, or you know, at any time for that matter. I have here my notes to Matthew Fox again, and I'm going to call attention to it again. Compassion. Very important term. I've almost become known on the Luther College campus as Mark, have you read Matthew Fox's book on compassion, Lund? I almost introduced myself that way. I'm not going to try to oversell this too much. I don't know Matthew Fox. But I think that this world is desperately lacking in compassion. His explanation or definition of compassion is very good. But basically what he's saying is that people who care enough about others, that they're willing to learn about the problems and then act on them. And I don't think that we have that. And that's going to surface many times as I talk about capitalism today. The first four lectures, I guess if there's one slogan I have before I get to this, the first four lectures, it would be, if you want peace in this world, I think what we need to do is find some ways to develop this compassion and then go out and work for justice. The first four lectures that I present will be, I'll try not to give you too many of my, or express my point of view too often. And I'm not going to say much about solutions. I want to provide some framework for analyzing the issues. And today the issue will be the capitalistic system. Tomorrow it will be Reagan economics. But in there I'm really interested in economic growth. That's the real question that we're going to be dealing with, is growth. I mean, supply side economics. Is it desirable? Is it possible? Then on the third session I'm going to deal with the energy problem, which is a major problem, but certainly more specific as opposed to looking at an entire system. And then the fourth session will deal with inflation. And then finally, what do we do as responsible citizens about some of these issues? And then on the final session, we'll talk about some solutions, and I'll say a little bit more about my point of view. As far as ground rules go, today, I'd like to, in my presentation, do it without trying to encourage too much discussion at the outset. That may be a problem for some of you, but I'll just give you a little background. First of all, I've taken who knows how many economics courses in my life, and all I've ever had is straight lecture. That's part of the system I came up in. The second problem is I've found that when you talk about economics with individuals who have not studied it a great deal, when you open it up to discussion too early, you get an enormous amount of myths and misconceptions that get thrown around, and it becomes very difficult to sort through what's really true and what is half-truth and what is really false. So I want to present some material today, and so I guess the ground rules will be, at least over the next 20 minutes or so, say a little bit about what capitalism and socialism are, and then the last 15 minutes open it up to discussions, and I'm not sure exactly what time we started, but I'd say at about 10 minutes to 12, officially break for those who are so polite that you will stay here until we officially break. And if anybody is interested in staying around, we do have the time. I'd be happy to continue with any discussion. The lecture today is going to assume that your background in economics is minimal. It's a lot easier to start there than to start at some other point and then find out that not anybody is with you anymore and you've left everybody behind. And as Mao said,
part of development really is trying to ensure that we all rise together. And in the process, we leave no one behind. If I were to give this presentation at Luther College, I would put a lot of emphasis on socialism as an interesting alternative and as a system we need to look at more. However, at this setting, I suspect I'm going to have to put more emphasis on capitalism and why I think that's a good system. And so I won't say anything about what I think of the systems. And in fact, I'll even add, it isn't until we talk about the issues tomorrow that we can really deal with future systems. The whole story isn't here. But I'm going to just try and give you the information without being too biased, although I'm going to put in a few plugs for capitalism today. By the way, about 75-90% of Luther College tends to support capitalism. I always get a chance to ask that question in classes, see what the students have to say. And so, just to give you some idea. Well, first I want to look at capitalism and socialism as they exist on paper. This will be theoretical. Try and help set the framework for our analysis. I'm going to give six characteristics of the two. Now, the real economist in me is coming out because I don't know if any of you had an economics class, but they always work at the blackboard, don't they? And I feel lost if I don't have chalk in my hand or a blackboard to lean on. First, in capitalism, we emphasize the ownership of private property. That means that you can own land, you can own natural resources, you can own equipment, machinery, capital. You have the right to private ownership. That's a real motivating factor in the system, knowing that if you work hard, you can own that land, you can buy that land. So private ownership by individuals or, say, stockholders, is a very important characteristic of capitalism. A second one is freedom. Terribly important to the United States, and I'll be using freedom as we know it here in the United States. Freedom as a consumer to buy what you want. You don't stand in line and get the coupons that say you're entitled to one pair of boots or whatever per year, but you go out and buy anything you want. And I won't tell you what you should buy or what you can't buy. We may, through advertising, work very hard at trying to create wants, but still, you have the right to make the decision what you want to buy. So there are freedoms. Freedom of the consumer. Then, based on what the consumer wants, there are other freedoms. There are freedoms of enterprise. You can work to some extent where you want. You do have that freedom to look for a job, or start up a business, work with some big multinational corporation. And you also have the freedom to use your resources any way you want. So if you own land, you can decide how you want to use the land. Nobody else tells you how to use it. If you own different facilities, buildings, you produce what you want. Now these two freedoms, the freedom to produce what you want and the freedom to sell your labor where you want or sell your resources, depend on the consumer. I mean, I might want to produce, I can't think of anything offhand, but that I think is a great product. If nobody wants to buy it, or at least at my price, my lowest price, then I am limited by that consumer freedom. But in our system, we take great pride in the freedoms that exist. Third, we emphasize self-interest. Self-interest says that you make your decisions based on what you want to do. We don't have to get together, at least I don't think we have to, as a family, or as a college, in my case, or as a state, or whatever, or as a church, and everything we happen to purchase, or every economic decision we make, get together in a group and decide what we're going to do. It's self-interest. It's what you want to do that's important. Four, we emphasize competition. It's at this point that I think that capitalism really gets a bad name. I'm talking about capitalism on paper now, because we don't understand what competition really means in the capitalistic system. But these first three are powerful motivating forces.
self-interest. You can accumulate. You have these freedoms. They are so powerful that you need something to prevent those drives, those motivations, from becoming very destructive. And the redeeming feature in capitalism, in theory, is competition. Competition means that we have many buyers of any good, and we have many sellers. And because we have many buyers and many sellers, I, me, in my own self-interest, want to make all kinds of money when I sell something. But if there are many other people selling that same good, I have to compete with them, and they may undercut me. So that limits my ability to go out and really abuse the system, let's say, and get real rich. Same as a worker. I may think as an economist, I'm worth an awful lot of money. But if there are a lot of economists out there all bidding for the job, it'll prevent any of us, unless we can form some kind of a cartel or collusion, from really getting and earning a lot of money. So competition really constrains, puts limits on this self-interest in the capitalistic system. But it says there must be many buyers and many sellers in each market. Now, usually when I talk about the first three, to me it sounds kind of depressing in a way. See, self-interest, you can get good and greedy and rich and freedom, and you can accumulate and accumulate. There's another thing in addition that sort of offsets that, at least for me, what I think is sort of a negative feeling that I get from those first three, in addition to competition, and that's what Adam Smith called the invisible hand. I don't know if you've ever heard of Adam Smith's The Invisible Hand, but anybody that talks about capitalism, socialism, is... I'll try and sit here for a while. I feel like I don't see half of you. is involved in this concept of the invisible hand. Adam Smith said this: if you wanted to do what was best for the society, you really wanted to do it, and you got together, and I don't know, in case say it's Holden Village, and we all sit here and we try to decide what's the best for Holden Village, he said you would have all kinds of problems. You would have the do-gooders, you'd have good intentions, but in the process you'd waste so much energy and time, you'd be inefficient, and you wouldn't do a very good job no matter how good your intentions were. But through capitalism, through what he called the invisible hand, he said the system will automatically provide for the, or maximize the well-being of the whole country. And economists are concerned about maximizing well-being for a country. We want people to have as much material goods as we want. By the way, I'll challenge the definition of economics tomorrow. I won't challenge it today. We want to maximize that well-being. And the way you do it is to let everybody go out and be individualistic, pursue their own self-interest, and through some invisible hand, the end product is that society maximizes its economic well-being. Why? If I want to get rich, I can only do it by providing a good that some of you want. And so I have to serve your needs. But rather than going through getting committees and having people travel all over and try and coordinate this activity, I provide the product, I see what price I can get, and if you're willing to buy it, fine. And I know I'll produce more. I can only get rich. I can only move up. Oh, I hate to use all these terms. if I meet your needs. And the market system, which is number five, where we have supply and demand. That's for any good, there's a supply that comes brought into that market and a demand for that product. Through that market, through the price system, the invisible hand works. Now, I usually say to the students at this time, this system is ingenious. It would have to rank with the invention of fire, the wheel, whatever. It's incredible. You have people responding to prices and seeking their own self-interest, good motivating force. And what's the end product? You maximize the well-being of the country. Gee, I mean, what more could you ask for? people responding to prices. That doesn't cost much. You just look at prices. And you say yes or you say no. Well, the sixth characteristic is a limited government. We don't need, the government does not need to play a very important role in this whole system. Let me move to socialism. Socialism, if I was to summarize it or give you a simple definition, socialism is really a response to the inequities that developed in capitalism. I'm moving away from something on paper and theory to something that where they examine capitalism in the real world. But it's a protest against the inequalities of a capitalistic system. And socialism looks like this. There are a lot of misconceptions about socialism. But first of all, you have social ownership of property. That means that it's owned by a group, maybe the whole nation, national ownership. It could be a workers' cooperative, but it's not owned by the individual. It's owned by groups or by the nation. The purpose of this is to try and eliminate the concentration of power on the part of a few individuals. You don't want power to become too concentrated. And so with social ownership of property, hopefully that's one possible way, or it makes it possible to eliminate this concentration of economic power. Secondly, in this system, the only way you earn income is by working through your labor. You can't own it by owning machinery, because it's owned by, say, the group or by the nation, or by owning land and just charging rent and sitting home. You need to work in this system. And again, that should reduce some of the inequalities. Second, on freedom, I don't know exactly what I want to add here. Freedom in a socialistic system often means that you're free if you really understand the world around you and you are involved in the decision-making process. You can participate in most phases of, in most decisions that affect you. It's a little different concept of freedom, and that's probably an issue that you can spend a lot of time on. So I'll just, I think I'll move over that one to three and say that instead of self-interest, we have a collective interest. You work for the social good. It's a very moral system. It's one where, as I mentioned earlier, everybody rises together. People are not left behind. Very moral consideration here is extremely important. Then four, here we have competition. In this system, it's cooperation. We work together. Five is probably where the, well, I guess five is, I've got the market. You use a market in almost any system. How do you allocate goods and services? It's through prices. You have to find some way to allocate. But the big issue is who's determining how that market works, who's making the decisions. And in this case, we get a much bigger government role in the market. In fact, we get central planning. Some countries have tried to decentralize. We usually associate socialism with a big central plan, a national government that's deciding what to produce and who's going to receive the goods. But there are other versions of socialism. Well, I want to just summarize a few things in these two systems. First of all, the real motivating force in capitalism appears to be private property, self-interest, and competition. That's where the motivation comes from. And if you want to look at it as a moral system or not, that's a question we need to ask. Is that where you want the motivating force to come from? Self-interest, the accumulation of private property and competition. In the other system, socialism, the motivating force tends to be working for the good of the group, community, cooperation. It's a very moral idea. The strength of the two systems. Many would say the strength of capitalism is freedom, the single strength. Just an enormous amount of freedom in that system. Again, remember I'm talking about on paper now. The strength in socialism is more equity, far more equity. The major weakness, what's interesting is when you go up to the weaknesses in the two, you just switch. The weakness in capitalism tends to be inequality. You get a lot of inequality in the system, whereas equity was the strength of socialism. And in capitalism, the strength being freedom, the weakness in socialism tends to be a lack of freedom. The stories we tend to hear more than any other, the stories we tend to hear are, well, there's a lot of force and coercion in this group decisions. And how do you get people to work? And who does the central planning? A lot of coercion takes place, and therefore a lack of freedom. I want to say a few things about some assumptions now, and then we'll move on to 2 and 3. Adam Smith was the person who first wrote in any systematic way about capitalism. And Adam Smith, I think, has taken a lot of abuse unjustly. We're all making fun of Adam Smith at times. But Adam Smith wrote a book before his Wealth of Nations. His Wealth of Nations really laid the ground rules for capitalism, or tried to describe it. His book before that, it's written about 10 years before, maybe 12 years before, was on moral sentiments. Adam Smith was a moral philosopher. And I think the major problem Adam Smith made was when he wrote his book, Wealth of Nations, he forgot to say, I assume you've read my moral sentiments, and you know that's where I'm coming from. And if you don't understand that, capitalism, you won't fully understand the book I wrote on capitalism. So Adam Smith stresses three things that are very important, and they're related somewhat to these characteristics of capitalism. First, he says that you should not let economic power become concentrated. That's the beauty of this system. And even when you hear Milton Friedman talk, he'll say, the great thing about capitalism is power never becomes created. You don't get too much power concentrated in one area because there's always that threat of competition and people can accumulate the power. Well, Adam Smith would say that if you don't have many buyers and many sellers in each of these markets, you're playing with a very dangerous system. Real potential for a great deal of injustice. Second, he said, there will have to be some role for the government to play. He wanted a minimal role. But it's surprising that when you read his book, he was willing to have a lot more government than a lot of people say he was willing to go with. If you're going to have a government, you must have one that does not show any favoritism towards any groups in the economy. It must promote free enterprise system. And Adam Smith would say that a government can be corrupt and it's going to create problems for the system. Milton Friedman, who loves capitalism, is the main proponent of the free enterprise system and has had a real big influence on Reagan economics, also says that the problems we have today are the government. We've got a government that tampered with the system, and that's why it's not working very well. And the third point, and this is the most important one, I think. Adam Smith said that moral sentiments are the foundation for capitalistic system. He talked about terms differently than we did. He talked about the need for sympathy. Sympathy to him, I think, is what compassion is to Fox. I think that's one reason why I like Fox, is because for me, Fox has been able to rekindle an interest in this whole idea of compassion or moral sentiments or sympathies that Adam Smith talked about, but we haven't, as economists, been talking about for a long, long time. And really, we're not talking about it much at all still today. Sympathy means this. You have the ability to think through how your actions affect other people. And you can put yourself in their shoes and understand how they feel because of any economic activity you've undertaken. He talks throughout that book, not being a moral philosopher and not trained in that area, a little difficult reading for me, but he says in there's a process through which a society goes to reach a fairly high level of moral development. And even though he knows we are not perfect, he thinks societies are capable of achieving a fairly high level of moral development. Well, Fox says we've lost compassion. I think if
if Adam Smith walked into the United States today and he looked, he'd say, you don't have any idea what I was talking about in moral sentiments. That foundation is being lost, and it's creating problems. So Adam Smith would say that if you don't have any of the three things, you know, a good distribution of economic power, a good government, and you don't have a sound moral foundation where you care about others and you think of through how your actions affect them, this system is open to abuse and misuse. Doesn't have to happen, but the potential exists for it to be abused and misused. I don't have the time today. I wanted to say something. This is where I like to get interdisciplinary. Has anybody here heard about a fellow by the name of Kohlberg? I think he operates out of the Washington, D.C. area, if I'm not wrong.
Is he at Harvard?
Okay. And he does, I think, seminars too. But he talks about what I've understood to be the six stages of moral development, which I find fascinating. And that sometime during this week, I'm going to have to bring those in. Because my last statement on the two systems before we move to number two is that I think both systems rely very heavily on a high level of moral development. I'm not seeing anything new. It's just that we economists haven't been talking about that for a long time. So it seems new to me. To many of you, it may be old. Reinventing the wheel, just one more round. But for the people I work with, it's very important that we start realizing some of these things. And how do you reach this level of moral development? I might add that has become the number one, I think, question that I have been asking in the last year or so. How do you create a sense of compassion? How do you develop moral development? Where do you start? Part of the reason is, in my classes, when I get students who show a real interest, a sense of compassion, I always ask them, when did that develop? Of course, I'm hoping that they'll say, oh, it was your class. I never thought of it before. But it doesn't happen. They tell me something happened when I was young. It happened in my family. It happened with friends I was with or whatever. But when I was young is where the seeds were planted. All you did was rekindle a certain interest. Well, that's been frustrating because any of you here who have worked in issues that Matthew Fox were talking about, trying to promote a more just society or world, know how frustrating it can be at times. Well, where do you try to teach compassion? My wife and I are becoming very interested now in parenting for peace and justice. I also think that if we're really going to make some changes there, it has to start in the early grades. I'd like to, if I had time sometime, write some material for Sunday school to really get into the nitty-gritty issues of oppression and injustice. I don't have the foggiest idea how I do that right now, but I really see a need also in the school systems. We don't do a very good job of trying to promote peace through stressing justice. My third point, or second point, is what happens when you move into the real world? Do these assumptions hold, some of the ones that I've listed? In the United States, the question has become, I wish I'd brought this poem by a colleague of mine. I just didn't think of it at the time. But the question is this. I'm going to write this big enough so you can see it and I don't have to say it. Not doing so good there. Which is correct? Is Adam Smith correct, or is it really Adam Smith? Adam Smith or Adam Smith? What's right? Well, I think in the United States, capitalism has worked fairly well. I can't say much for the last 20 years or so. But I say that because of the assumptions. For many markets, we've had many buyers and sellers. The government hasn't been overly corrupt. You need to be in other countries to see what corruption can really look like at times. And moral development. I guess I like to look for the good in people, and I think there's been a fairly high level of moral development in the United States. I say that when I talk to my parents, and others in that generation, I'm impressed by the attitudes that they had, the idea of working hard, and I think they kind of understood the invisible hand. They had sort of a giving mentality. I'm going to go out and work hard because I'm producing something that somebody else needs. And I think that's important. I don't know about my generation. I was born just after the war. And I'm afraid that I belong to a spoiled generation. Never seen a bad day in my life. I don't even have any idea what it would mean to be hungry, to worry about a job. Of course, remember, I'm white, male, and middle class, and so I don't have to worry about some of those things. But we've become pretty spoiled, and I think we're losing that sense of compassion. This idea of where you work, it's a sort of a giving mentality. That scares me. I don't like what I'm seeing. But in general, I think in the United States, to a certain extent, capitalism has worked fairly well. Although the new enemy may be technology. It'd be fun to get into that, industrialization, urbanization, and all that that brings. In this quest for competition and trying to produce, we've gone to sophisticated technologies. You read Jacques Ellul, The Technological Society, and you realize that we've, in some cases, almost developed a monster there that is very hard to control. And well, what about, I want to move from the United States just for a couple seconds. When you go to a third world country, we talk about the free enterprise system in a third world country. I've been in a few of the countries where the free enterprise system works, and all I can say is it's a disaster. The assumptions just aren't there. They're not even close to the assumptions we have in the United States. In the third world, there aren't many buyers and sellers in a number of the markets. The multinationals have come in. The government tends to be very corrupt at times. And a level of moral development, I know Peru best, but I cannot believe the way they treat people down in Peru. I mean, we think we abuse people. It's just terrible. And in some of those systems, I just don't see, I mean, the basis just isn't there for a free enterprise system. And what makes it worse, when capitalism entered the United States, it came with a very large, I don't know if I could call it middle class, but a large middle class developed in the process. People came over to get ahead. They worked. There were a lot of buyers and sellers. And we had the entrepreneurs, the creative innovators. And there were a lot of people that got in on that. When capitalism moved into many of the third world countries, it joined forces with the elite. There was no middle class. It never developed. And we don't have the people who save, who have that giving mentality that we had here, who are going to work hard. By the way, I have to be kind of careful. I'm almost sounding like the U.S. culture is the only culture. Oh, I don't want to come across that way. But it's just a different system there. When you move to the international system, and that's my topic for next week, so I'm not going to say much about it now, but you look at the concentration of economic power between the North and the South, and try and tell me how any international system could ever function for the well-being of all people when the power sits up North, and there's hardly any in the South. And that which is in the South is in the hands of very few who have plugged into the international system. Some of my favorite economists, and there are a couple of real good ones, Muhab al-Haq from Pakistan, says that any economic system, international system, that has such an unequal distribution of economic power can only mock poverty. It ignores poverty. They don't even get into the system. That's for next week. But I just, I did want to look at capitalism in third world settings and also in the international setting. Oh, by the way, I might add that, in case somebody wanted to pick up on this later, the Lutheran response was the Manifesto for Our Nation's Third Century. Are any of you here familiar with that, or any of the Holland staff? This came out with the Bicentennial. And what's so fascinating about this is the American Lutheran Church response, by the way, they used the term manifesto. That was a mistake. If you go down the two sides, what they have said is we need to balance the two. We need to balance individual initiative with social consciousness. We need to promote private enterprise, but still have a sense of public duty. We need competition, but there must be cooperation. There must be ambition, but still compassion. We need pride, yet humility. National survival is very important, yet there must be service to the world. And then human knowledge and spiritual wisdom must be balanced. And I can remember when I first saw this, I was kind of excited about it. But I have had some real problems understanding how you combine some of these things since I first saw it. But that has been one response to all of this. Well, let's see, the final item, the future. I'll say much more about that tomorrow, but I just want to throw out a few ideas and then I'll open it up. One is, a lot of my colleagues say we have a fallen world. And the best we can do is to use the capitalistic system because there are so many freedoms in there. And let's accept that it's a fallen world. And if you want to move over to socialism, as Nyerere says in much of his writings, that is a way of life. You have to believe in it if you're going to make it work. And they would say that is just too moral for us to handle. And so you end up with a lot of force and coercion, and the system isn't very good. And I have an article here, if anybody wanted to read it, by Milton Friedman, who claims that capitalism is not moral or immoral. Socialism is not moral or immoral. But he does say, you look at the results of capitalism around the world, and you look at the results of socialism, and he says you'll find that capitalism's results have been far more humane. Well, that's one way of looking at the future. Another is to be a dreamer, to have a vision. Some of the dreams are, well, I should say, there's another one. If you have the fallen world, what we tend to do is sort of go the liberal route, and we're trying to patch up the system. And the government comes in and takes care of the problems when they surface. It tends to be a little piecemeal patchwork. But that's one thing we've done. And we're not hearing much from the liberals now. Then you have the conservative movement, which is saying, let's go back and try and get as close to the pure form of capitalism as possible on paper. Get rid of the government. Let the private sector take over. But then we have some other dreamers. We have dreamers who are interested in socialism. But socialism means atheism to so many people. And it's just not a very good term. But Tanzania, some countries are looking at socialism, democratic socialism. And then there are a lot of people today talking about an entirely new system. A system, like Fox says, is based on compassion. It's based on our interdependence, the fact that we are all related to each other and that we must think in global terms. I guess a lot of work is, a lot of thinking is being done in that area, but it's all quite new and experimental. We have, say, 5-10 minutes, and I would love to hear any feedback you have, any ideas, any thoughts, because I need to do some learning. And I realize I did a lot of talking today, and I'll try not to do as much in the future, but it's the first day I needed to give you a little background, and thank you for being patient and listening. If there is somebody who, because it is 2:15, and I think that's when we officially are supposed to end, feels that they'd like to leave, that's just fine. If someone would like to stay around and discuss some of these issues or give me some of your points of view, I'd love to hear them. Yes?
Mark, this is kind of a question. I have been told, and I don't even understand Ward Keynes and Adam Smith, how they, I guess, capitalism is based on something that Keynes, we call it Keynesian capitalism, is that right?
Well, yeah. I think the liberal movement would be Keynesian economics in that we recognize there are problems in capitalism in the real world. And so Keynes came along and said the government must play a much larger role to try and prevent these inequities and to help those who are the unfortunate. And so yes, we are Keynesian economics because we've let the government do much more than it would under free.
But what I had heard from someone was that in Keynesian economics, the point was that you taxed heavily during lean years or when there was a lot of money available and a lot of goods and services and so forth, and when it was sparse, then you let up on the taxation, and that in order for the system to work, that's what had to be done. But that doesn't happen in our system, and therefore Keynesian economics is not feasible for us. Is that a false statement, or I just would like that explained a little bit more, or is it just so far off base?
Well, I mean, there's an element of truth to what you're saying. I don't think that's what's really wrong with Keynesian economics. I think the problems are far greater. The way we behave, consumer behavior, our attitudes have changed, and that's why we're having problems with Keynesian economics. But what Keynes would say was that over the long run, your government budget would be fairly balanced.
so that when you tax heavily during the good years, you'd build up a surplus, and during the bad years, you would spend more than you brought in, and you'd run deficits. And up before Keynes, the idea was balance the budget. That's very sound. Well, along when Keynes came, said, no, we moved to something called functional finance. It has to be very functional. So what we're going to do is control the economy. We're going to aim for full employment, low inflation, and hopefully get some economic growth. In order to do that, we will let the government run deficits or surpluses, whatever needed to control the economy. Hopefully, over the long run, those years would even out. In the long run, we'd have a balanced budget. But even then, it didn't really concern him a great deal if it didn't balance. Right? It would be nice if it did. As far as the problems in that is that we run deficits year in and year out. And I think we've had maybe three surpluses since Eisenhower, including Eisenhower. And they've all been like a billion or less. They've been very, really quite small. The problem with running deficits is, I think, the effect it has on inflation. And I'll say a lot about that during the fourth session. But if Keynes in economics is wrong at all, it's because, I don't think it's because we've just run deficits and surpluses. It's just the way we've let that affect the rest of our economy. And what Keynes did was put a floor underneath the economy which said prices won't fall too much, we won't have too much unemployment. And we've made it difficult for people to, be careful about this, I can say like Reagan's group said, we don't have poverty in the United States anymore, whatever that statement was that came out a few months ago. But we've made it so that poverty isn't, we put limits to how low poverty can go because we have a lot of programs. And I know I'm rambling because in order to really say what's wrong with Keynes, you need to work through the whole inflationary problem to show why Keynes in economics does not do a very good job of solving inflation. Keynes in economics does an excellent job of solving unemployment, but not inflation. And I think that's where the Keynes in economics has got us into more trouble than just because we've run so many deficits. That's a part of it, but it's the inability of Keynesian thinking to handle inflation. Yes?
You're talking about capitalism. My basic assumption about capitalism is that inevitably there are inequities. There are rich and poor. And if that moral development that supposedly Adam Smith thought would be there, is that there on paper then? Should that be different? There wouldn't be there.
No, I don't think. He's not opposed to inequities. We were born with different talents and different gifts, and certainly there will be inequities. But in any market, he would hope that there would continue to be enough buyers and sellers. And when he was living in 1776, when that book was actually published, that was the system of the day. There were many markets. We didn't have the monopoly capitalism that we have today. And so, I mean, he accepts inequality. But if he doesn't want that inequality to lead to, you know, real big concentrations of economic power, and that's where Marx comes in. And I suppose if we had time, I'd do a session on Marx and say why Marx saw the internal inconsistencies in capitalism, that they would lead to inequalities. And they would, economic power would become more and more concentrated. I forgot to mention this, but Fox in his book too asked the question under psychology and economics. Is it really possible to have a system that's based on accumulation of goods, that's based on he doesn't use the term greed, but he does later on in that section. Greed and self-interest and competition. Can you have a system that's based on that? Can it really be more in the long run? Is it really possible? And that's why my colleague has written this poem, Adam's Myth. And Fox doesn't think it can be. In the long run, he doesn't see how that system can come up with the results that we really want. Many of the economists that I deal with would say, no, that's wrong. If there's something wrong, it's because the government was granting too many favors to the Rockefellers or whatever, so they could get rich, and those who put in the railroads could get all of that land. Just made them rich. So he accepts inequalities. I just don't think he ever anticipated the changes in technology, and the scale at which we produce, and he assumed we would be fairly moral in our actions.
Just for information, Mark, does Milton Friedman, whom you typified as a proponent of his close to Smith as we might see on the horizon. Is he in favor then of limiting the power of corporations? For example, if the problem is the concentration of economic power, and that is subversive of a capitalist system, and does Friedman oppose the growing conglomerates and the increasing concentration of economic power?
My understanding of that would be that no, he doesn't oppose it. He still thinks that there's enough competition.
Oh, among the nationals.
And always the future threat. And you see, he would go free market worldwide and say that would ensure that we'd have the competition. Yeah. What he doesn't like is that government exists and those big companies can use the government to grant them favors. And so he's just opposed to the government even being there because they have good intentions in many cases, but they either foul things up or they don't have good intentions and we see some corruption in favor granted. So he isn't terribly opposed to that.
No.
I won't say too much about my feelings right now, but maybe later. Did you want to follow up on that?
No, just a little bit of irony here because Richard Barnett, who is regarded as a socialist, is opposed to concentrations of power of any kind, both government and in economic life and businesses. So he favors decentralization of both the central government power and of the corporations. And in this scheme, he comes closer to capitalism, whereas Friedman, who's a arch capitalist, not opposing the concentration of multinational corporations, strikes me as something else. Although there is a lot of competition among multinational corporations, if you want to cast that on the international scene,
I think Friedman
nonetheless is a kind of rigging a market as far as the consumer is concerned.
Sure, I think Friedman would say that. I assume he'd like to think that there's more responsibility on the part of corporations, the big corporations. He would say that. When they compete, they will compete honestly. And the problem is when you get that big, there's all kinds of collusion that's going on. And so you're abusing. He would say that they would abuse the system because of the power.
Yeah.
And one of my major themes lately has been, it's power. I mean, when you talk about economic development, which is my area, it always comes down to power. Mm-hmm. Who has power? How do they use it? Do they abuse it? Do they have too much?
Yeah.
And development to many is a more equal distribution of power, which is what Barnett is saying.
Yeah. Can I just follow through on one thing here on the moral dimensions of this? Lewis Mumford's thesis is that capitalism is rooted in certain moral values. And what's necessary to get started, you have a strong Calvinist notion of integrity and honesty. So you have a notion of a social contract that you and I, as buyer and seller, we can assume honesty on each other's part. We can assume something in the way of quality of workmanship. There are a whole lot of things that capitalism had as moral, in the way of moral foundations. And Smith says that they are necessary and that they are there. Mumford says that at the same time, the capitalist system appealed to all of the seven deadly sins except sloth. Avarice, greed, the whole range is appealed to. His contention is that the system appeals to those, it eventually undermines the very moral foundations that allowed it to come about in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested in if you see any reality there. At that point, I think you would say Adam Smith was correct about what was required to get started and to keep it going in the way he envisioned it, but that the system itself made appeals to other values which eventually corroded the moral foundation.
I can't elaborate on that much. That's the point of view that the theologian I teach with in the Peace and Justice course takes, that that those six deadly sins, whatever, will undermine the whole system. And that there's no chance. I think Fox is basically saying some of the same things.
And I would guess, just from a gut feel, not being, having read that or really having a chance to think through it, that it sounds like there's an enormous amount of potential there for that being accurate. The thing that my colleagues would probably come back and say is, well, sure, we're not perfect. Why do you want to continue to talk about a perfect system where you're going to have to, the only way you can carry it out was an authoritative, benevolent dictator who's going to force and coerce and tell people what to do. And they'd say, of all the systems, maybe it's the best thing we can do. And so I don't think they would even deny that, that it may undermine that moral foundation at times. But they would say, what's better? Well, I let them talk. Yeah. And I listen to them, but I...
But it may also be why we're getting two responses now, namely about capitalism and morality, and they are at absolute loggerheads with one another. Namely, the moral majority in favor of capitalism, who wants to reinstate a particular morality for the whole culture, not just the economic system, and wants government to have a role in that, and a libertine response that says keep governments off our back and is essentially hedonistic in its morality, or says essentially you do what you wish, also as ardently in favor of capitalism.
So
I think that may just represent the ambivalence that's been there since the beginning.
Yeah. And Milton Friedman says too, what right do you have to tell me what to do? Or what right, it should be an individual morality with freedom. What right do you have, like the moral majority or whatever, to impose on everybody else your sense of morals? It's the freedom is so important. I want to get to you.
I was wondering if you think that in the model of capitalism, that competition works as an effective component today when to get ahead and to gain or profit. Especially multinationally, everything's so capital intensive. I mean, capital's already invested there, and it doesn't seem like to get that much capital, get ahead with such high technology, seems it limits your competition so much. I don't see that it works to limit the concentration.
Clearly,
does that model work today?
Yeah, the argument that's made, at least on an international basis, is that we just don't live in Adam Smith's world. I mean, it seems fairly obvious, but we live in an era of monopoly capitalism with sophisticated technologies, and this world just doesn't exist. Milton Friedman might say, well, there's still competition amongst those people who are at the top, who have the capital, can get it and produce, and they will compete, and they will provide a good very cheaply for the consumers, providing there's not too much collusion between them. But when you move to an international system, what's happening is those people who have that power, they attract the dollars. I mean, when I talk about international trade, and no two sides will trade with each other if there aren't going to be some gains on both sides. I mean, if you do, you've got to have your head examined if you're going to enter a trade negotiation where you know you're going to lose. But the few gains that do come, what happens to those gains? Karl Marx will talk about it as a surplus. They're attracted to wherever the money is and where the high returns are. And so once you get big and powerful, you just siphon off the surplus and the resources, and it makes it very tough for the people who really need the surplus to make some improvement or to develop. It makes it very difficult for them to get that money that's so sorely needed. And so that's why I say that whole system, many would say, just mocks poverty. Whatever surplus is developed amongst the poor, whatever, if you're going to invest it, where do you invest it? You're going to invest it with some company that gets a 20% return or something, and who already knows how to do business. And the problem is that people get left out. It isn't that they're not efficient. See, a multinational corporation is so efficient, they have such good knowledge, access to information, incredibly efficient. It's just that there are very few people that are part of the system. Most of the people get locked out of it. So it's a very different system, monopoly capital, from the Adam Smith idea. But there's a lot of interest today to go back and try and promote small business. That's why I like Schumacher too. Small is beautiful. We've been trained in this country, probably many of the northern countries, to think that big is better, as Schumacher says. The more sophisticated is better. And so whenever you see engineers working on anything, it's always enormous and complex and expensive. Where are the innovators, the entrepreneurs who are working on the small changes? I don't think that you have to be that big to reach your economies of scale, the lowest cost. In all areas,
think there, we just don't, we aren't, we don't think in those terms. And it'd be nice to see more emphasis on small business and more decentralization. I think that's an exciting area, although I don't know how you compete with what were all those stores we kept seeing as we came through towns on the way out here. It's really tough for the corner drugstore and the corner grocery to go against the...
This doesn't seem like competition's going to come in on its own, but at the same time, you can't expect government to break up or enforce the competitive component in there when everything is already so intensified in a set market.
Whenever I get into these topics, the issues you're raising, I guess it's when I feel a real need, at least on my part, to learn more about the technological society and what it's done in this whole process of development, the technologies that we've developed. What has it done? Has it almost made it impossible to ever return or to go back and capture some of the assumptions that we think we need and some of the characteristics that are on, at least on paper there? Technology is a blessing and a curse.
Then, like my professor of oceanography at my school, I was telling us that, like the anchoveta fishery in Peru, for instance, we buy our technology, the canneries and everything down there. We buy almost everything that they harvest, and it comes up here and it feeds, our stock.
Yeah, I'll say more about that next week, and I know you're leaving today, but the problem there is. When you have, that's where I say it, this, the buyers are in the north. I mean, when when our per capita income runs anywhere from $9,000 to $10,000 to $12,000 in the countries in the north, and the per capita income for the people in the south, Asia, Latin America, Africa, is $200, $400, where's the buying power? It's up here. So if some country can sell, the people who own those resources can sell to the north and really make the money, and they can't afford to buy it down there, it's going to come to the north. And if we want to use land in other countries to produce goods that we will consume up here, it's going to happen. That's why I say the money is attracted, or the resources get used by those who have the money. And that's why when you have these inequalities like we have on an international system, which are so great, it's very difficult for those who are poor to improve their levels of life. It's really tough. You have to be in a third world country to look at the resources and then say, where are they going and who's using them, and then to hear the people talk about them. If people came into the United States and bought up a fourth of our land and then took the raw materials and shipped them down to Africa or South America and produced goods for most of the people down there, if you would come back to our elite, how would we feel if we looked out there and we saw those resources all going to other countries? It's a painful thing, but we're not on top of it. We don't see it. We don't see people living on marginal land because the good land's owned by some big corporations that aren't even producing for the people who have these local needs because they don't have the income or the money to buy those resources and to use them for their own needs. Yes?
You'd be working some with the conference coming on a new international economic order?
Next week I was planning to, but I've been told at Holden that the way it works is if somebody's interested in something, you just go find them,
yeah,
and you start talking about it. And I'm here to learn, and I'd be happy to talk about some of those things.
I don't know much about it, except I know that it's some attempt, and I know that many of our people have even heard about it. Yeah. It's been around for a number of years, but I don't think we've talked about it in our churches or anything else.
No, you're correct, and it's an important issue.
I'm wondering if that compares in any way or combines some of the strengths of the two that you shared with us.
No, it's very important. I think the tragic thing to me about the New International Economic Order is it's saying let's take the existing system and make sure that we don't abuse those powers and give the poor a better chance. In other words, it's asking for equity, something fair. Not even asking for drastic changes at all in the economic systems as they work in the countries or around the world. It's just saying that if we have all the power up here, we should be able to twist someone's arm and say, you're going to send your goods up on our ship. And so I guess what bothers me about it is it's such a modest request on the part of the South, and yet the United States rejects it and votes it down and has done everything possible.
Well, it's been hidden. I don't think we even know about it.
Yeah, you're sure. Yeah. You know, I want to make one more statement because I say this because I think I'm being honest. I need to paint the full picture, and that is, I have a lot of relatives and friends around in the Midwest, and when I talk to them about this, I'm convinced that they're not rotten people at all. They care. They don't understand these systems. It's part of this the institutional injustice that we just aren't aware of because we don't think about it, we don't talk about it, and we don't see it. And so I would say that some of the problems may be planned. I mean, some may be rich because others are poor, and it's carefully calculated and planned out. But I think much of it cannot be blamed as a conspiracy on the part of the North. I just know too many good people who, just as you said, they haven't heard about it, and they haven't done anything about it. If they did hear, why don't they hear? I'm going to come back. I may have finished too. Back to Fox, compassion. We're losing it. There is a woman who came to Luther and said, "We've lost our ability for imagination. We just cannot think of how other people feel." Why? Because on television we watch all kinds of violence and suffering and whatever, whether it's in Biafra when they're having the problems there, the drought in East Africa now, and we see it, and it's just one more picture. We've lost that ability to feel for other people. And I think if we could recapture some of that, plus maybe take a little more seriously our responsibility as I would say, at least as Christians and global citizens, then we would address some of those issues. And certainly there's a real lack of. When I ask my classes at Luther, who's heard of the International Economic Order? No, a couple of hands go up at the beginning of a semester. We don't know about that. And yet our country has a very poor record in the way it's handled it. Just as many of you may have heard about the Nestle's. I'll come back and say more about that. The reason why I feel so close to it was in 1976, I was teaching at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, and I belonged to the Minnesota Coalition for Development. And we had a couple people there who said, we got to do something about Nestle's and all these infant deaths. And every time we'd meet, she'd want to talk about this. So finally, she said, let's have a march in Minneapolis and a protest. Well, okay, you know, you've talked so long, you deserve some attention, we're going to help you out. So we planned it. Well, it turned out I left Concordia College and moved down to Iowa and wasn't around. But that summer, they had the boycott, and they marched downtown Minneapolis. Now that boycott is nationwide. It's in, I don't know if it's in 17 or how many countries. And the World Health Organization finally took it up on its agenda. And the United States and two other countries were the only three who voted against it. And then the other two changed their vote. Yeah. And so now we are the only one on record going against it because, what does that mean? You're interfering with private enterprise. And no moral decision do we want to make on that. And it started in Minneapolis in a little, the Catholic Union there. Newman Center, right in Minneapolis. And our country was the one that voted against it.